Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Democrats and Republicans are desperately trying to push President Trump to halt family separations. Melania Trump expressed her sentiment in a statement. She said, "She hates to see children separated from their families and hopes both sides of the aisle can finally come together to achieve successful immigration reform." Former First Lady Laura Bush said, "I live in a border state. I appreciate the need to enforce and protect our international boundaries, but this zero tolerance policy is cruel. It's immoral, and it breaks my heart." She continued, "Our government should not be in the business of warehousing children in converted box stores or making plans to place them in tent cities in the desert outside of El Paso. These images are eerily reminiscent, in my opinion. These images are eerily reminiscent of the Japanese-American internment camps of World War II, now considered to have been one of the most shameful episodes in U.S. history," end quote. Those are very strong statements that conjure up horrific imagery of America's not too distant past in terms of Japanese-American internment coming from the wives of current and most recent past Republican presidents. What's being missed in this discussion is the money being made off the backs of these immigrant families. Sarah Huckabee Sanders justified the policy last Thursday by describing it, almost laughably, as biblical. Quote, "It is very biblical to enforce the immigration law that is actually repeated a number of times throughout the Bible." Well, here's what Sarah doesn't understand. It's not law. It's policy. A policy that can be reversed by the president simply calling Homeland Security and saying, "Don't do this anymore. Do it another way." Sessions is lying. Huckabee Sanders is lying. And the president is lying. Here's the president.
Do you agree with children being taken away from
the border? No, I hate it. I hate the children being taken away. The Democrats have to change their law. That's their law.
Sir, that's true.
Why do you keep lying about it, sir? That's the Democrats' law. We can change it tonight. We can change
You're
it right now. I will leave
right
here.
Now.
No, no. You need their votes. The children can be taken care of quickly, beautifully, and immediately. The Democrats forced that law upon our nation. I hate it. I hate to see separation of parents and children. The Democrats can come to us as they actually are, in all fairness, we are talking to them, and they can change the whole border security. The Democrats have control because we don't have the votes. The Republicans need more Republicans, frankly, and that's why I think we're going to do so well in the midterms.
Jeff Sessions announced a zero tolerance policy at the border on May 7th.
Because he's following the law. No, he's following laws. He's following a law that was
a direct order to.
Can I answer your question, please?
Yes.
Okay. You're just asking me the same question over and over. He's following laws, very simply, that were given to us and forced upon us by the Democrats.
But there's no law that says families have to be separated at the border.
The Democrats gave us the laws.
It's not the sole purpose behind this draconian and racist policy, but you can't ignore the fact that Trump's Make America Great policies may have resulted in misery for thousands of poor migrants, yet the rise in human suffering has resulted in jackpot prizes for some players in the New York Stock Exchange. According to Mint Press, U.S. private prisons are largely controlled by a handful of monopolistic firms or real estate investment trusts, with GEO Group and CoreCivic, formerly Corporations Corporation of America, or CCA, standing at the helm of the industry. For-profit prison operators threw their weight behind Trump's Law and Order campaign in 2016. Following this election victory, both GEO and CoreCivic continued pouring cash into his till and gave $250,000 toward the inauguration celebrations. Last November, Immigration and Customs Enforcement called for five new detention facilities to be built and operated by private prison corporations across the country. ICE spends more than $2 billion a year on immigrant detention through private jails, and ICE and U.S. Marshals Service pay GEO $32 million a year to house, feed, and provide medical care for 1,000 detainees. Scarcely a month after Trump's inauguration ball, the prison company's stock prices rallied to previously unheard of heights, nearly doubling in market value. Their profitability has continued to rise as market speculation and new influxes of taxpayer dollars driven by overcrowding resulting from the exponential boost in migrant incarceration fuels profits extracted from largely Latin American refugees fleeing conditions primarily created by U.S. imperialist policies in their home region. I talked about that last week, U.S. foreign policy creating the circumstances in these countries that are forcing these individuals to come here. The new regime is expanding quickly and utilizing all the tools left behind by the Obama administration. Immigrant rights activist and undocumented Bellingham-based community leader Maru Mora Villalpando told Mint Press, "They have made it easier for jails and now prisons to start detaining immigrants. Plus, they're looking at expanding or creating new private detention centers for adults and children," she added. Final point. Sessions and others tout this policy as a deterrent to individuals and families attempting to cross into the U.S. from Mexico. Well, the data shows otherwise. According to Customs and Border Patrol website, during the month of May, Customs and Border Patrol saw a slight 1.9% increase overall when compared to April, but a 160% increase compared to May of 2017. It's not the law. It's a policy, but a very lucrative policy for the private companies operating these detention facilities, and it's failing as a deterrent. Israel targets rights groups by attempting to outlaw filming of soldiers. So last week I told you that amid scathing accusations of war crimes, the UN voted 120-8 to condemn indiscriminate Israeli violence against Palestinians. I guess in response to this, yesterday, Israel moved to snap the lens shut on rights groups that film its troops' interactions with Palestinians by introducing a bill that would make it a criminal offense. Rights groups frequently film Israeli soldiers on duty in the occupied West Bank. Documentation, the organizations say, is necessary to expose abuse by the military. The proposed law, formulated by the ultra-nationalist Israel Bientu Party in Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's governing coalition, would make filming or publishing footage with intent to harm the morale of Israeli soldiers or its inhabitants punishable by up to 5 years in prison. The term would be raised to 10 years if the intention was to damage national security. A ministerial committee which oversees legislation voted to approve the bill on Sunday. It will now go to Parliament for a vote that could take place this week and, if ratified, will be scrutinized and amended before three more parliamentary votes needed for it to pass into law. This decision aims to cover up crimes committed by Israeli soldiers against the Palestinian people and to free their hands to commit more crimes, according to Deputy Palestinian Information Minister Fayez Abu Aita. He told Reuters, "Personally, I think that his position is correct. It will be a lot harder for the world to hold Israel accountable for their war crimes and ethnic cleansing if video documentation of these atrocities are criminalized and the brave photographers, correspondents, and videographers are imprisoned." You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The Supreme Court left unsettled the issue of politically motivated redistricting today, rejecting two appeals from Republicans and Democrats, but failing to rule on the merits of their claims. For insight into this and to some other issues, we turn to my first guest. He is the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse. You know him through his investigative reports for BBC Television, The Guardian, Democracy Now!, and Rolling Stone. He released the post-election update of his film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Case of the Stolen Election. You can get the film on Amazon and Amazon Prime or at gregpalast.com. He is Greg Palast. Greg, welcome back. You're becoming quite a regular here on The Critical Hour.
Well, I guess that may be bad news. It just means that there's all this, there's mendacity
amongst us.
America, there's a lot of problems.
So Chief Justice John Roberts wrote, basically we had a Wisconsin case, we had a Maryland case, and you've got Democrats in Wisconsin challenging the Republican Party's redistricting maps. You had Republicans in Maryland challenging the Democrats' redistricting maps. And Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that in the Wisconsin decision, he said the case was flawed because it was about group political interests, not individual legal rights. He said this court is not responsible for vindicating generalized partisan references. The court's constitutionality prescribed role is to vindicate the individual rights of the people appearing before it. He writes that as though class action suits don't exist.
Oh, look, what they're doing is that they're ducking because they know it's time to say that democracy is endangered by gerrymandering, which is getting with computers. It's just gotten so mad that now the lines that are drawn are far more powerful than the voters that vote. If you show me the lines, I tell you who won the election. Now, that's an old story because there's a guy named Gary in Boston a couple hundred years ago that drew the lines on maps to, and that's how we ended up with the gerrymander.
Because his map looked like a salamander.
Yes, his map looked like a salamander, exactly. So you know that. You know your history.
Well, a little bit. I hang out with you.
Yeah, And so what happens is, look, it's old stuff, but here's the deal. Until now, the courts have said, well, yeah, it's partisan, which threatens democracy, but we have no information. How do we measure what's a fair district and what isn't? Well, my background is, I have a big background in statistics, and the answer is, that's what statistics is all about.
Duh.
So once again, they punt it. In other words, they decided not to take on the issue of whether you can draw districts which are clearly nasty partisan fixes so that the Republicans. Well, let's put it this way. Overwhelmingly, if you add up all the votes for the United States Congress, the Democratic Party crushes the Republican Party, crushed the Republicans in 2016. And for every election going back two generations. So how come Democrats are not in the majority in the House of Representatives in Congress?
It's because the way that their district lines are drawn.
Gerrymandered, right? They got written out. They took those crayons, and Texas had some of these wild maps. Like you say, they look like going back to look like salamanders. But now with computers, you can split blocks. You run lines down a half a mile through this, down the center of a street. You run lines underneath lakes. And, and I saw the Democrats do this in New York. In fact, I was part of a team that helped actually went into a room and said, how do you want your district drawn? I was working for a politician. And they said, first time I ever used a computer mouse was to what we call the finger to draw an opponent out of the district, literally put his house outside the district by running a line in an alley behind his house, a district line, then back up the middle of the street, And, you know, so listen, I know how to do it because I did it.
You know, Greg, a lot of people really don't understand the power of the data now. And you've said this a couple of times. You've talked about the computers, the computers, the computers. But you now can go house, you can go block by block, house by house, and you can determine who lives in that residence, how they voted. You can go back as many years as the data is available, and you can determine trends. You can look at demographic shifts. You can look based on race, based on education, based upon income. There are the data, the power of the data now is unlike it has ever been. And I don't think that people really understand that when you have the command of that data, you really now have the command of democracy.
Well, here's the deal. What we have now is computer-aided apartheid. And it is drawing very, very careful ghetto lines. And while, you know, one of the things that the court has said, so the court has actually taken on the issue of unfair gerrymandering. It says you can't do it in a way which is overtly, overtly racial. Okay? Believe me, if it weren't for racial drawing of these lines, you would have a very different Congress. So it's only when they get caught, when it's so clear that they have reduced the power of voters of color. It's another trick of vote suppression. Put you in a district where your vote doesn't count. And, you know, and by the way, this whole business in Ohio, which is actually related. For example, in Ohio, you could lose your vote. It was a trigger to begin losing your vote if you don't vote in a midterm election or you don't vote in a couple state elections. Well, as you know, one of the things that the Republicans have become expert at is what they call stacking and cracking. And one thing that they'll often do is take black folk and basically create one super black district where all the black votes are in this kind of electoral ghetto. And so you have, you know, there's no sense voting because the Democrat has it locked. You've got some congressman or a state senator who's been there for 20 years, and they're not even running. There's not even a challenger on the ballot, or it's a challenge. And so there's no reason for you to vote. Well, guess what? Then you lose your vote because you didn't vote. Well, why didn't you vote? Because there's no one on the ballot. It's not a contested election. So they ghettoize the black vote, and they say, oh, you didn't vote. Well, why were we voting? You know, what was there to vote on? Because you've jammed us all together in this one place. And then you have a big part of the black community, which is then spread out. The rest, the people that aren't in that electoral ghetto, the black vote is then spread out over five surrounding districts and has absolutely no influence on the outcome of the election in those five districts.
Because the way they draw the lines, they split up those people so that their impact is minimal, if at all.
Yeah. In other words, the idea is, okay, so you stack in as many black folk as you can in one district, and then you draw out the ability of black people to affect the elections in five surrounding districts. And so you don't vote in the middle, in the one in the middle. It's all locked up. And then the other five, you don't bother because it's locked up for the GOP. So in other words, basically, they put you in a place where your vote simply doesn't count. And it's super partisan and super racial, because you know those things go together. We know those things go together. And so what happens, the court has said, oh, we're just not going to even talk about the issue because they know that it's going to be impossible for them to avoid the question that gerrymandering, as it's done now, is just as partisan beyond imagination. But basically, it ends up shafting the Democratic Party mostly, though one of the defendants. In Maryland, it's a heavily Democratic state, as you know, so Democrats are playing the game. I talked about how in New York, the Democrats play the game, and in California, they play the game. But for the most part, not in California. California actually is a judge-drawn election. And believe it or not, the Democrats, when you have fairly drawn lines by the courts, not by politicians, the Democrats clean up. The Democrats will always do better if you have fairly election districts which are drawn in a fair and reasonable manner, not to include or exclude anyone. And that's what the GOP majority on the court fears. So they just said, we're not even going to take the cases. They came up with cockamamie excuses not to even hear the cases.
The court's constitutionally prescribed role is to vindicate the individual rights of the people appearing before it, not generalized partisan preferences. Again, he wrote this as though a class action lawsuit has never been brought. Now, before we get to your suing Ohio and Kansas, I want to just quickly hit, because one of the issues or one of the excuses that is used ad nauseum in these voter suppression tactics is vote fraud. And so just like the president keeps saying it's Democrat law that has forced him to separate children from families, and we know that no such law is on the books, the Republicans also continue to talk about vote fraud. And in the Ohio case, they talked about protecting the interest of seeing to it that there isn't vote fraud. But a man who knows his statistics, it's like 0.00003% of the votes in this. I mean, it's statistically insignificant. But just quickly hit on the fact, why is vote fraud or the excuse of it just another lie or an excuse? It doesn't exist in this country.
Well, let's go back. Unfortunately, we always end up back at race. And by the way, here's an interesting statistic. A NYU professor, Loretta Minetti, who is considered the number one expert on so-called vote fraud, she said it's more likely you get struck by lightning than find a voter is an individual voter has committed voter fraud, because you commit fraud in it's a federal crime, 5 years in the can, and it's usually it's a crime in every state on top of it. And so people don't do it. For their one vote, they're not going to risk 5 years in the can.
Let me just quickly insert. It's not that mistakes don't occur. It's not that your polling precinct changed and you mistakenly go to the old one. The point of vote fraud is I'm not in Maryland trying to vote as Greg Palast, who I know lives in California.
Right. Now, here's the trick. Okay. And I just want to tell people what happened in Ohio, because this is really quite important. In the case of Ohio, the Supreme Court said that the state of Ohio had been could legally remove 500,000 voters. Now, what was the reason? By the way, the New York Times and these other papers got it wrong. The reason voters are removed was not because they failed to vote, not alone. It's because they failed to return a postcard. Stay with me on this. It's a failure to return a postcard. This is literally what happened.
Mm-hmm.
If you miss a couple state elections, like again, you know, you're in a district in the middle of Cleveland and there's literally no contested elections, you missed that election, they can then say, that's evidence you've moved. Believe it or not, they say, that's evidence you've moved. And so how do they make sure to check to see if you've moved? Not by checking utility bills, not by checking your taxes. Have you filed taxes in that state or get Social Security? That's easy, right? That would prove you're there, but just didn't bother to vote. No, they send you a postcard. Like that, doctor, they send you a postcard. And if you don't return the postcard, that is proof positive, according to the state of Ohio, that you have moved and you can be removed from the voter rolls. In other words, you don't vote. And then you get a postcard, you don't return it. Now, by the way, with the post office, if you've moved, the state gets back the card addressee
undeliverable.
Undeliverable. But if you're there, the card goes through. The fact that the card went through and they didn't get it back is actually proof.
You're still there. And you just threw it in the trash because it looks like junk mail.
So why would they do this, doctor? So 1.5 million people got these postcards, and 500,000 have so far been removed from the voter rolls. By the way, almost all the rest will be removed. There's a delay period. So the question is, this postcard gimmick, this is purge by postcard. I uncovered this in 2014 for Al Jazeera and then later for Rolling Stone. And I write about it, by the way, gregpalast.com for the details. What they do is they know that, number one, the people who get triggered that have missed an election are more often than not minority voters.
Mm-hmm.
Second, one-third of those voters, over 400,000, we're on what we've talked about before, the cross-check list.
Mm-hmm.
Cross-check list says the initial accusations that two people, for example, in Ohio, and I'll give you a real name, Donald Alexander Webster, was accused of being the same voter as Donald Eugene Webster Jr. of Virginia. Now, they didn't arrest him for voting twice.
Right.
Instead, they said the fact that he registered in Virginia was proof that he left Ohio. Now, I went to go see Mr. Alexander Webster in his home in Dayton, where he's been there for many years. You won't be surprised to learn that he is a black man.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is Donald Eugene Webster Jr. He's never changed his name to Eugene or Jr., but they use that as evidence that he has moved. Okay, like that? So what they're doing, then they send a postcard, and if he doesn't answer the postcard, now, he said he never got a postcard. You know why? Because it looks like junk mail. Go to gregpalace.com and take a look at that postcard. It looks like the worst piece of junk mail you've ever received, and you throw it out. And you know why it looks like a piece of junky junk mail?
Because that's what they want it to look like.
Find it that way. So a guy named Michael Wychocki is one of the nation's top experts on junk mail. That's what he does for a living. He helps corporations like Dell Computer get a response, you know, send you some mail and get a computer, right?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want the stuff thrown out. And he works the census, which doesn't want you to throw out those forms. So he says, this postcard, he says, I don't want to ascribe, I don't know what's in these guys' heads.
Yeah, malintent.
Seven rules to get a people's attention with a piece of junk mail. They violated all seven. It's as if, he said, it's as if they went out of their way to design the worst possible card for the least response. And why? Because they know that the majority of people on the cross-check list, because it's people with common names like Mr. Donald Webster, are black or Hispanic or Asian American. They know that people who miss some of these midterm elections, again, because, I want to emphasize it, because there's no contested elections in some of those areas. They're minority voters.
So real quick, you are suing both the states of Ohio and you're suing the state of Kansas.
Yes, and the reason for that is that Kris Kobach, Trump's vote thief in chief, who, by the way, and I don't use this term, as you know, very often, I'll throw this term around, he's a white supremacist, and I know that he's the counsel for a group called FAIR, whose purpose, stated purpose, is to maintain a European-American majority in the United States. And I hate to say it, doctor, that ain't you, okay?
No, it's not.
And so here's...
And they've already lost.
Voter rolls bleached whiter than white.
Right.
Kris Kobach, who came up with this purge by postcard system, he's the one who gave almost a half a million names to John Husted and said, send these people postcards. And so we're going after Kansas because Kansas and Kobach are directing the purge programs in 26 states. Ohio is one of the worst. Another one is, by the way, we're going to go after Georgia. Now, the one in Ohio, we're going after him with Dr. Bob Fitrakis, a great voting rights lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Illinois, we will be suing the state in coordination with the Reverend Jesse Jackson. In Georgia, we're going to be suing the state where they're pulling off this trick, too. And we're going to be suing Brian Kemp, who's running against Stacey Abrams for governor of Georgia. Brian Kemp's the Secretary of State. So he's purged the voter rolls. He's bleached the voter rolls white. Then he's running for office against a black woman who now faces the fact that she has to try to win, even though the voter rolls have been bleached whiter than white. So we're suing there, too. And we're going to be suing in all these states. I say we. I got a great law firm, Meyer Mazzocchi. The ACLU of Kansas has joined us in Kansas. And like I say, the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Rainbow Push joined Illinois. We have the Reverend Lowry, is the great civil rights leader.
Yes.
So Lowry's organization, the Coalition for the Georgia Coalition for a New Agenda.
One would think that the Democratic Party would have interest in this, and one would think beyond the ACLU, other civil rights organizations would be on board with this. But we're still not hearing enough about this on most of our mainstream media outlets.
Yeah, because they don't understand how terrible this is, and even some of the best voting rights groups cannot imagine this level of devious action.
So you're just a conspiracy theorist.
No, I get. I will say, and the good news is, for example, that the ACL, that the NAACP took my research and just won a case in Indiana based on my findings to stop the use of that cross-check program, which threatened over 100,000 voters in Indiana, almost all of them voters of color.
Mike Pence wasn't happy about that.
They even cited my findings that it was racist, et cetera. So the NAACP picked it up. The League of Women Voters is, I just got a note from them today. League of Women Voters is picking up my material.
Okay.
The Brennan Center for Justice.
Okay.
We have many groups, but remember, there is still one group missing. And they're called the Democrats.
Right.
And I know, and I can't give you all the answers, and I don't, you know, I'd have to reach into the minds. All I can tell you is this, and we know this, and I saw this because I live in California. If you change the racial makeup of the electorate, if you let everyone vote as they deserve to vote, you're going to have a very different Democratic Party, a very different Democratic Party.
You just hit the nail on the head.
Like Georgia, okay, where a Stacey Abrams, a black woman, is running as the Democratic Party candidate, and the establishment hated it, okay, because they said, oh, no one's going to vote for a black woman. Well, they said no one's going to vote for a black man, and he became president of the United States. But there's this great fear of a black party.
Mm-hmm.
Just say it. Let's just note it. And they spend half their time, you know, machine gunning each other. They don't want to change those voter rolls. And even the gerrymander is something that a lot of Democrats don't give up. When I was watching, when I was literally participating, I'll admit it, I was participating in the gerrymandering of the lines in New York. It was not to shaft Republicans. It was Democrats shafting each other, those who had the inside and controlled that map-drawing machinery.
Mm.
Shafting the other Democrats. The Democratic Party is involved in fratricide against progressives. I saw this here in the California primary, where the state Democratic Party, which is fairly progressive, endorsed a candidate for Congress in the primaries. And the National Party endorsed a right-wing Democrat. And they spent $4 million, the National Party, savaging the progressive Democrat. Now, the Democrats have better use than spending $4 million in a primary. This is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. I thought that their job was to fight Republicans. But this is why they don't complain about, in my opinion, about the suppression of the African-American vote, the Asian vote, the Hispanic vote. Because if all those voters actually ended up on the voter rolls, a lot of those Democrats would not be winning primaries. They would not be in charge of the party. They just wouldn't.
Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, their positions would become incredibly tenuous, and they would have to be much more responsive to the progressive voices in the country.
And the working class, and especially, like I saw this also in Ohio. Okay, it's very difficult for the Democratic Party to grasp this important and powerful problem. The other problem is that they are afraid of being seen as playing the race card,
right,
looking like they are defending black people.
Right.
You know, it's amazing. Like when, you know, a lot of people know me, you know, this is Greg Palast, because in 2009 covered how Catherine Harris removed over 50,000 black men, calling them felons who didn't have the right to vote. The head of the Democratic Party, a guy named Pope at the time, the head of the Democratic Party said, I can't get Democrats to join me in the legislature. The head of the party said this.
Mm-hmm.
Get the legislative Democrats complain about the removal of black people who are falsely accused of being ex-cons. Not one. And they just had, you know, common black names, and someone somewhere just got was convicted of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And they're innocent black people, but they didn't want to be seen as defending criminals. That's what was going on.
Right.
Defending black, and of course, how do you know that they're criminals? I said, but they're innocent. Well, everyone knows that they're criminals because they're black.
Right. And some of them had been convicted of felonies in the future.
Yes.
The database was so corrupt.
Yeah, but it was insane. insane. You had all these people convicted of crimes way in the future. You had people convicted of crimes before they were born. They were convicted. One guy, as I have him in my film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. I got this young man, a Gulf War veteran named Willie Steen, and he was denied the vote because a white guy in Ohio named Willie Osteen had been convicted of a crime. They found a black guy with a similar name in Florida and said, you can't vote, you've been convicted of a crime. And when he protests, they say, young black male, of course he's guilty of a crime. No one will defend him. And this is a big, huge problem. The Democratic Party is not there
when we need them. I got to stop you there. Greg Palast, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Case of the Stolen Election. You can get the film on Amazon as well as Amazon Prime, or go to GregPalast, PALAST.com. Hey, man, as always, thank you. You always so gracious with your time when I call. I really, really appreciate it, Greg.
Thank you, Doctor. Bye.
All right. Hey, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We're back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. After waiting for over 4 hours, the White House finally held a briefing amid outrage over the Trump administration policy to separate children from their families. For insight, we turn to my next guest. He is part of the White House press corps. He joins us anonymously for understandable reasons. He was there until the conference started but was called away, but he did listen to the entire conversation from a very, very close location. Good afternoon, sir. So tell us, what was going on in the briefing room after an hour or two of just standing there waiting and waiting for this briefing to start?
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Dr. Leon. Quite honestly, it's become a norm in this White House, in this Trump administration, and quite honestly, in this press room where we find ourselves, you know, we'll get a daily guidance of the president's schedule, and in past administrations and this administration, they'll tack on at the bottom a little note stating what time the press briefing is expected to start. In this administration, we've become used to it being delayed by at least 20 minutes. So quite honestly, in answer to your question, when we did get to about the hour mark, around the 2 o'clock hour, it was a little bit of annoyance, but there was no real surprise.
Well, okay, I can understand 20 minutes. I can understand 30 minutes. I mean, last I checked, the president is involved in some pretty, pretty serious stuff. So things can shift as you're dealing with Houthi rebels and you're dealing with all, you know, all kind of stuff going on in the world, but 4 hours?
Yeah, it's amazing. So
in fact, I'm sorry to cut, but 4 hours on a domestic issue. So that indicates to me that they were really trying to figure out what the heck they were going to say to y'all.
Exactly. And that was the consensus around the room. Quite honestly, you know, it went from a 1:15 briefing to being rescheduled to say, oh, we should start around 3:30. Everyone's there and ready at 3:30, and we hear an announcement over the speakers, oh, well, it's going to be at 4. So come back at 4, waiting another 25 minutes, standing around, absolutely nothing. One courageous reporter that actually has been known for getting into pretty public back and forth sparring with
Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Yes, Sarah Huckabee Sanders. His name is Brian Regan from the, I forgot his publication, but anyway, he's definitely known for, you know, his public spats. He goes into the back to what's called the lower press area, where a lot of Huckabee's assistants and press aides, you know, reside, and he gets no answer from them. He goes upstairs towards the West Wing to her office.
Mm.
All the doors are shut, and no one is there. He hears someone yell from around the corner, you'll get her when she comes down. So it just, you know, quite honestly, is a microcosm of not only the relationship between the press office and the free press, but also, you know, like as you said before, they're scrambling to find what to say on this issue. It's a microcosm of, you know, their response to the issue. I mean, in a day, Dr. Leon, where you literally have all four of the former first ladies coming out against this, and as you know, first lady is a very non-political
yes.
part of the administration. All four former first ladies and President Trump's own wife, the current first lady, coming out against this issue of the child separation for the immigration down at the border. I mean, you have Laura Bush saying, "I live on a border state."
Right.
She tweeted out not too long ago, "I live on a border state. I appreciate the need to enforce and protect our international boundaries, but this zero tolerance policy is cruel,
immoral, and it breaks my heart."
Think about that for a minute, Dr. Have you ever heard a first lady come out and say that?
The last time was never.
Thank you. So, you know, getting back to the—
Wait a minute. She went on to say, "These images are eerily reminiscent of the Japanese-American internment camps of World War II, now considered to have been one of the most shameful episodes in U.S. history." And her husband is a Republican.
Wow.
Former president. Her father-in-law, Republican, former president. That's about as politically damning
yeah.
as I think you could get, it, because there are no subtleties here.
Exactly.
It's not, for example, Donald Trump not showing up to Barbara Bush's funeral, right? That was a subtle and not so subtle snub. But here she comes out, both barrels blazing.
Exactly. And as you said before, her husband, her father-in-law, this isn't, you know, former First Lady Michelle Obama, who the right, you know, always would deem as some type of radical, behind-the-scenes liberal puppet master of the Obama agenda. This is definitely not former First Lady, you know, as he, President Trump will put it, you know, crooked Hillary.
Right.
Someone of your own party, and quite honestly, someone whose mission was to help children. So I think, you know, kind of getting back to—
By profession, she's a librarian.
Exactly. It really shows you what type of political times we're in nowadays. And
you were listening to the press conference, and give me a sense of what the head of Homeland Security, what was her defense?
Well, Secretary Nielsen, as you know, DHS head of Homeland DHS Department of Homeland Security, you know, she earlier this morning was at a sheriff's conference in New Orleans, and, you know, echoing basically doubling down, which is no surprise now from this administration,
mm-hmm.
basically saying we do not apologize for enforcing the laws that are on the books and so forth and so on. She comes into the press briefing, and by the way, as you mentioned before, didn't start until around 10 minutes after 5. You know, she comes in there, and basically, I will say this, in her own way, she was trying to come and seem a little less harsh,
mm-hmm.
more considerate. She made sure she mentioned the thousands of men and women that work, you know, for the department and other law enforcement agencies down on the border, and how they don't, you know, how they're doing such a tough job, and we need to make sure that as reporters, we respect them when we report. You know, she mentioned other ones, and I think Sarah echoed this later, about families who have been ripped apart by, you know, crimes committed at the hands of illegal immigrants.
Well, let me just quickly interrupt, if I could. When I saw the beginning of the press conference, Sarah comes out and introduces the secretary, and then it looks like she just ran off the podium. It was almost like, you here, I don't want this one. You take it.
It's interesting because they come in there, and that's been a tactic. I'll just call it what it is. You know, when the news gets a little bit too heavy to handle, sometimes you'll see not only they will delay the briefings for immeasurable amounts of time, but they'll also bring out sometimes, in a lot of cases, just totally random, either heads of departments in his cabinet
mm-hmm.
or their press secretaries to come out and handle questions and take the bulk or the majority of time. I don't know if you noticed today, Secretary Nielsen stood out there just as long, if not longer, than Huckabee Sanders usually does.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In my opinion, and a lot of other press corps members' opinions, they come out to eat up Sarah's time, and she'll come behind them. She doesn't go off and hide. She does stand in the corner, but you can kind of tell if things get a little bit too animated,
mm-hmm.
too many fireworks in the press room, Sarah will come to pull on the coattails and give the standard, okay, last question.
So how did I can't remember the woman's name, the Secretary of HUD, I mean of HHS, of Homeland Security, DHS, whatever her name is. How did she deal with the question of Trump continuing to say it's the Democrats' law, it's the Democrats' law, and there's nothing I can do?
She, quite honestly, you know, brought out a tactic that Kellyanne Conway, I feel, is really a great job of perfecting.
It's called the lie.
Answer, yeah. A lot of people call that, but reflect and then answer another question that was related to the original question, but not answering the mm-hmm. question. So in a lot of cases, people tried to come in different ways and ask her, Major Garrett of CBS, you had John Roberts of Fox News, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Brian of AURN, asking her in different ways, as you said, what is your defense if you're blaming Democrats? Why can't you fix this with a simple phone call to your own cabinet?
Right.
And she basically answered that question by going down to the border and saying, look, this is the way it is. We're just enforcing what former administrations did not enforce. And quite honestly, just running across the talking points again and again.
So on the basketball court, we call it the crossover. She went Allen Iverson on him and
exactly
and broke some ankles, put the crossover on him and broke some ankles.
That's a good way of putting.
So what was the deportment of the members of the press corps as they were dealing with her and she was shoveling this stuff back to them? How aggravated did they become?
Just to give you a little bit of sense, even before, as you know, they're aggravated waiting 3 hours, 4 hours, as anyone would. But some more videos and more footage of actual on-the-ground footage came out while we were sitting in the press room waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the members, you know, asked politely, you know, it's a live, everyone's talking amongst themselves and all that. One of the members asked politely, do you all mind if I play this on my computer? Because a couple of people around her wanted to see. And I tell you, the hush that came over the press room while we're waiting for Secretary Sanders to come in, Dr. Leon, when you can hear, you know, immigrant children wailing and crying for their mom. And the lady was just playing the footage, and people were visibly disgusted. So, you know, fast forward to when Secretary Nielsen finally does come out, you know, it's no wonder you have people that are, you know, parents themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Their job is first to report the news and ask the tough questions. But, you know, you got parents themselves sitting there.
The day after Father's Day.
Exactly. And asking poignant questions. You know, a CNN reporter asked her point blank, how can this not be constituted as child abuse?
Mm.
You had Yeah, and it was a basic question. She couldn't give a yes or no answer. You know, you had Kristen Welker of NBC asking a basic question. Why are we only seeing the actual official department release photos of these children? Why are we only seeing teenage boys and young men on these photos? We don't see girls. We don't see children. Is that a specific, you know, in other words, to me, her question was leading to, is there a reason why?
Mm-hmm.
As to try and, you know, portray in the media that all the kids down there are criminals and, you know, young men and, you know, giving that whole context to the conversation. She wouldn't answer that straight. So I feel like I said, with more news of this whole entire story kind of breaking by the minute, and you're seeing the footage, you're seeing the faces of the kids crying and, you know, literally babies being ripped from their mother's breasts, you know, literal stories of that.
Right.
And when they asked her about it, she says, I didn't see those pictures or I don't know what you're talking about, but we will fight all abuse. You know, the frustration was visible.
You know, one of the lies that's been told throughout this story, they continually try to put it back on the Obama administration. And we know that the Obama administration did accurately earn the title deporter in chief. So he has deported a whole lot of folks. But one of the things that kept that keeps getting put back on him is the number of children that were detained by the Obama administration. But the fact of the matter is, yes, the Obama administration has or did detain more children, but those were children that came to the border alone. They were not children that were separated from their families and then put into separate detention facilities. Those were children that were traveling by themselves. And so those children had to be managed another way.
Exactly.
So the way that the Trump administration just continues to lie. In fact, I was really shocked. I was listening to a press conference from a couple of days ago when the president was talking about this issue, and two or three reporters said to him, "Why are you lying? Mr. President, why are you lying?" And he ignored them, but that audio did make it through, and I was amazed at if you could just quickly, have you noticed between the press corps dealing with the Obama administration and the press corps dealing with the Trump administration that the current circumstance is much more aggressive than it was with Obama?
Oh, I think there's no doubt. I honestly think there's no doubt. And that quite honestly started with Trump on the campaign trail. He called reporters out. You know, he openly mocked them and, you know, insulted them.
Yeah, we remember that famous video.
Right. And the press are people, too. You know, I'm not at all, you know, advocating for bias, you know, as a reporter or anything like that. But the press are people, too. So they remember that. And quite honestly, his attitude and you know, posture towards the press has funneled down through not only his campaign's press office, but now his administration's press office. One quick story. CNN, you know, he always calls them fake news and you know, just totally derails them, in his campaign styled stops and all that.
Mm-hmm.
This day, one thing people don't know, CNN actually had to hire, out of necessity, a personal security detail all throughout the campaign whenever they covered Trump events.
Mm-hmm.
Because that type of rhetoric,
mm-hmm,
we fueled all types of incidents against CNN press corps. They were advised to cover up any decals or logos or stickers on their clothing or their equipment and basically go in rogue when they had to do their job and cover his campaign. So,
especially when you then look at the demographic that he was appealing to, and in those settings, when he starts talking about, get him out of here, get him out of here, that type of language, let's just say, is more incendiary than it is calming.
Exactly. And I think you and I both know Obama's press people never did anything like that.
So at the end of the conference, and this is, we've got about a minute left, at the end of the press conference, did you get any sense, because a number of people were thinking that the administration is being moved to a different policy, or did you get any sense during this briefing that a shift is afoot?
I honestly do not. If any shift would be coming, it definitely wasn't from the press conference. There may be a slight, you know, glimpse of hope, you know, for a lot of these children being separated when he meets with Congress on tomorrow. I think it's on his schedule for 5 o'clock for sometime tomorrow. Other than that, you know, if a congressman can get in his ear, because a lot of Republicans are quite honestly openly against this.
Mm-hmm.
Someone can get into his ear, perhaps he will, but.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham. When somebody like Lindsey Graham is saying this isn't right, that means a lot because he still has direct access to the president.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, we'll see on tomorrow. But, you know, leaving the press office, you know, it was just basically another day at work.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you.
All right. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all tomorrow right here on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.